Welcome to Sputnik, orbiting the world with me, George Galloway.
And me, Gayatri.
According to the laws of aerodynamics, the bumblebee cannot fly. Its wings are too flimsy, its body too heavy.
But fly it does. According to the laws of Russia's enemies, sanctions on an unprecedented scale were to wreck the ruble and crash the Russian economy.
The opposite has happened. The ruble has more than recovered its early losses, and it is the European and North American economies which are looking distinctly rocky.
Now, how did that happen?
Legendary man of words Pepe Escobar predicted exactly this. So let's hear from the oracle. Pepe, thank you for joining us on board the Sputnik. Before we go into all the other predictions you got right, give me a new prediction as to what's going to happen now with the oil and gas that was depended upon by Germany in particular, the European Union as a whole. Are they going to pay in rubles? Or are the taps definitely off?
Yes, it's no rubles, no gas, George. Look, I don't make predictions. I try to follow the course of history, of course. We're just students in the middle of all this, right? But today was the big bang, absolutely. Because Putin, in an absolutely devastating speech, he declared open the season of if you want to buy our energy, you have to pay in rubles. You have to open an account with a Russian bank, most certainly Gazprom Bank, and Gazprom Bank will take care of the proceedings. The full documents are not ready yet, but we know that this is how it's going to work. And he gave, one day before, he gave a preview to Chancellor Scholz in Germany explaining why Russia is doing it. It's because of you, dummies, in the European Union. So we have to protect our interests. It's very, very simple. It's a new era that is right in front of us. And it's an era of a resource-based reserve currency, which is something that we never had with the U.S. dollar. And that is the complete game changer. This geoeconomic judo that Putin and Russian leadership perform very, very quick. In fact, it's absolutely devastating because it's the lineaments of a new world system. In fact, this is how the great Immanuel Wallerstein will define it if he was still among us.
Well, he is an acknowledged judo expert, and until all of this, he was the honorary president, I think, of the whole world, judo-wise. The question is he a great chess player? Because on one level, if the Germans agree to put their euros into one teller at the Gazprom Bank, and Gazprom Bank promptly turn that into rubles, that, in theory, gives Russia a very powerful lever on what the exchange rate to the ruble is going to be.
You're absolutely right, George, because they're going to set the new ruble rate, in fact. And when we look at the progression of the ruble this past week or 10 days, it's absolutely astonishing. It's back to the level that it was before the start of Operation Z in February 24th. And it's amazing because, in fact, there were a lot of internal measures, of course, capital controls, laws over Russia, how Russian banks should deal with foreign currency, stopping the flow of foreign currency outside of Russia, including via oligarchs as well. Oligarchs put aside, which culminated with Anatoly Chubais, one of the most nefarious faces of the 90s, leaving Russia for good. So, and on top of it, the global South, the most important thing, the global South, slowly but surely, I would say, in fact, very, very fast, they started to understand that this was, okay, where are they going now? They're going to more or less establish the ruble as a reserve currency. Because don't forget that we have been discussing paying gas with rubles for 1 week, 10 days now. And now China knows it, India knows it, the BRICS knows it, Saudi Arabia knows it. They are starting the Petro One negotiations with China. India, they are starting the ruble-rupee mechanism. Russia and Iran are starting on a swift bypassing mechanism. It's all over the most important actors across Eurasia and across the global south. So the path towards the ruble as a strong reserve currency and the world monetary financial system being upside down is already there. And we're not even talking about the most important development, which we're going to know more about in the next few days. It's the new monetary financial system that is being more or less discussed between the Eurasian Economic Union and China, with Sergei Glazyev, one of the most brilliant Russian economists, at the head of this process. So we can say for sure, it's not a prediction, but just following the course of events, that within the next few weeks, we're going to have the lineaments of a completely different ballgame in terms of international financial economic relations.
We are living in the time of monsters while this new world is being born. And those monsters are being crushed in the Russian military operation, especially around Mariupol. You wrote quite brilliantly, I must say, about Mariupol this week. You see it as having an enormously important future in as a kind of hub in this Eurasian entity that is hoving into view.
Yeah, that's right, George, because Mariupol is a sort of steelworks mecca in the Sea of Azov. For all practical purposes, Mariupol is going to be part of the Donetsk People's Republic, which means either it's going to be part of the future Novorossiya, which will be a union between Luhansk and Donetsk as independent republics, or via referendum in both of them, they will be incorporated into the Russian Federation. So there is a very strong possibility that medium term, Mariupol is going to be part of the Russian Federation. And in terms of strategic positioning and industrial positioning in the Sea of Azov, very close to the Black Sea, and interconnecting the Eurasian Economic Union, something that is very, it's not well known in the West. It's called the International North-South Transportation Corridor, which is basically a maze of highways, railways, port connection with India, Russia, and Iran as the most important partners. And of course, the Chinese New Silk Roads. So you can have this enormous industrial port, Kuma Steelworks, in Mariupol, in the Sea of Azov, interconnecting with Crimea, with the rest of the Black Sea, and then you cross the Suez Canal, go to the Indian Ocean all the way to Asia, distributing stuff to the Eastern Mediterranean as well. It's going to be very important because Azovstal, the steelworkers, they're already there. But during the, I would say, the neo-Nazi infested 8 years in Ukraine, they were not at the height of their capacity. They needed upgrading. There was no money, etc. Now, as part of this new conglomerate, Donetsk, Novorossiya, and probably Russia all together, the possibilities are endless, and shipbuilding as well. So Mariupol is one of the most important future hubs, medium to long term, of this emerging process of Eurasian integration.
So, Pepe, is it true that around 90% of Mariupol is now free of the Azov Battalion, which therefore means that the prospect that you just beautifully pictured to us will come closer to reality?
Well, look, the latest information that we have is very fresh. It's from this morning from Ramzan Kadyrov, his own account on Telegram. Ramzan Kadyrov is... He's the head of the most hardcore Spetsnaz on the planet, the Chechens, which are part of the encirclement of the neo-Nazis in Mariupol. with Russian forces and with Donetsk forces. He said that between 90 and 90% of Mariupol, the whole city, which is 500,000 people, it's a huge city, there were battles that are absolutely horrible all over because essentially the neo-Nazis were keeping most of the civilian population as hostages, and most of the population was surviving in bunkers as well. So now the 5% that is not liberated is parts of between 3,000 and 4,000 Azov battalion neo-Nazis, which are entrenched where? In the Azov style steelworks in Mariupol. They are completely surrounded, and it's going to be a take-no-prisoners scenario. These people are going to be completely exterminated, especially because these are the people that are mostly responsible for the reign of terror, and there's no other expression to define it, against the civilian population of Mariupol. So once Mariupol is liberated, which is something that could happen in the next 2, 3, 4 days, then the process of reconstruction begins, and that's going to be because the city is partially, but at least 50% destroyed. But the future is bright long term, of course, because then it's going to become a major industrial hub and pole in the Sea of Azov.
In 30 seconds, Pepe, are we going to shiver this year for a lack of gas, or is something going to be worked out between the EU and the Russians?
Well, it's being worked out, George, after the initial very childish EU response. No, we're not going to pay. It's very simple. The Russians didn't say anything. It's very simple. These are the new rules. You don't pay, you get no gas. So this conversation between Scholz and Putin, because Germany is the most important, of course, industrial power in Europe and depends heavily on Russian gas, Nord Stream 1, especially, even if they don't put Nord Stream 2 online, they are going to reach an agreement. It's not such a very complicated thing to open an account with Gazprom Bank. You put your euros over there, it's transformed into rubles, and you get your gas. It's not a big deal.
Let's hope that prediction is as good as all your previous ones. Pepe Escobar, thanks for joining us on board the Sputnik.
Thanks very much, George. My pleasure.
Coming up next, another fine journalist talking Syria, Russia, false flags, and fanatics. Don't miss it. Welcome back to Sputnik. According to a royal house which helped pay for it, $2 trillion was burned trying to destroy the Syrian Arab Republic and replace it with the alphabet soup of Islamist fanaticism.
It was another American plan which went wrong. When Joe Biden was walked back from declaring regime change in Moscow, Secretary Blinken said the US had no intention of such a thing, either in Russia or anywhere. It was reported that this made the horses laugh.
Stephen Sahyuni is the Syrian-based editor of Mideast Discourse, and he joins us now.
Stephen, thanks for coming on board the Sputnik. You must have been very surprised when you heard Antony Blinken say that the United States is not trying to bring about regime change in Moscow or anywhere else. After the 10 years that your country, Syria, has gone through, that must have come as quite a shock.
Yeah, it is a shock because that is what the American administration, this administration and the administrations in the past work on. And it is regime change. Either they do it by a military invasion like what they did in Iraq, or they do it by supporting radical Islamic terrorist groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, al-Nusra and other, or what they're doing now by supporting fascist groups, Nazi groups like Azov. So that is what America, they use these groups or they use the media on demonizing, like they used to demonize the Soviet Union in the 80s and 90s, then the Islamic Republic of Iran, then Iraq, Syria, Libya, and others. And that is what America. America does not want any country to be strong like they're also doing with China. They don't want any country being strong to stand in their, as they say, stand in their face. And that is... And that is what America and their number one weapon is their mainstream media and the Western media outlets.
Well, they failed, of course, in Syria, although not without a decade of blood and terror and the expenditure, we're told now, of $2 trillion to try and bring about regime change. That's one big effort at regime change. And it doesn't seem that they're going to prevail in the Ukraine either. So you wonder what they're going to do next. You mentioned this extraordinary ability to be supporting Islamist fanatic head choppers in one country and supporting Nazis in another country. Does it make you nervous that they may still have one last desperate throw of the dice? The fake weapon of mass destruction, a ploy that they played in Syria. You think that there's a danger they might do that in Ukraine?
First of all, there's no difference between Azov and the radical Islamic terrorists, if you want to call them the Muslim Brotherhood, or you want to call them Jabhat al-Nusra or any other, because both of them are fascists. And both of them, they work on making, on killing, they're correct, and the other... everyone else is wrong, and they should be. Everyone else should be killed. That's the fascist mentality. But in Syria, let me tell you, and my experience in Syria and the Syrian war about the chemical weapons. Us Syrians, before any chemical attack happened, we saw on videos by the terrorist Islamic terrorist groups, video by a terrorist group in a with gas mask. And with rabbits, and they used and the gas, the chemicals that they had in their hand was from the TEK company, who is Turkish, and they used it on the rabbits. And they said in the videos, "This is for the Syria. This is what we're gonna do to the Syrians." And they said this to scare. Several days after that, the first chemical attack happened in Syria, and that was Khan al-Assad. Then, after that, the Syrian government, to try to accuse the Syrian government. After that, the Syrian government asked for the United Nations to send investigators, and they did. And when they arrived in Damascus, the day they arrived in Damascus, East Ghouta happened. Also, the media worked on. And every time there was a meeting for the Security Council or international meeting about Syria, the day before they used to do a chemical attack to accuse the Syrian government and to get, because what they wanted is military invasion on Syria. So if anything happens in Ukraine, and if any chemical attack happened in Ukraine, it is not the Russians, it is the Azov and the Ukrainians supported by the Americans and the Secret Service, CIA and European Secret Services.
Now, the situation in your country is, of course, vastly improved. Most of the country has been liberated from these terrorist groups. But a part of Syria, and a very important part, remains in the hands of these people, and the United States is helping them. How do you see that developing in the next period? I presume the intention of the Syrian government is, as they have declared, that every square inch of Syria will be liberated.
That is true. The Americans are has invaded the east of Syria, where all the wheat is and where all of the oil and gas is. And that's why Syria has a shortage of electricity and fuel is because the Syrian government has been needing to import and buying. While on the other hand, our oil and gas that Syria has enough for the Syrian people are being stolen by the Americans in the east of Syria. In the north west of Syria, where the Islamic fanatics are and the radical Islamic terrorists are, like al-Nusra, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, because they keep calling them, changing their names, supported by the Turkish regime, Turkey. Also, they have been taking a very important place, invading a piece of Syria. And that's why also in that city of Idlib and suburbs of Idlib, also Syria grows a lot, and it's land for crops. So that is the two most important places in Syria and geographically in Syria for the Syrian economy, either the oil or gas or the crops, is being taken by either the Turkish and the Islamic terrorists or by the Americans. And that's why the Syrian people are suffering of lack of electricity, lack of energy, and also the sanctions by the United States and the European Union on Syria, Caesar law.
Of course, there are Russian forces in Syria at the official request of Syria, and they are still there, I believe. But now with the war going on in Ukraine, has that affected the amount, the activities of the Russian forces that are in Syria?
Actually, no, because at this point, there is not that much, there's no battles happening. Like, but it might start any minute or any day. The Syrian army with the Russian air force and military in Syria are prepared. And they, and that's why, in my opinion, that's why Russian defense minister Shoigu came to Syria right before the Ukrainian operation on the Russian operation on Ukraine. Is because to be prepared, because the Americans, they might use these Islamic terrorist groups to cause chaos in Syria for the Russians and for the Syrians. And that's, but it won't affect, because the Russian military and the Syrian military, especially the Syrians, has been being prepared already on all, either if it's in north of northwest of Syria and Idlib, or in the east and the desert of Syria. And why I mean the desert of Syria and by Palmyra is because there is pockets for ISIS hiding and being protected in Al-Tanf, where the Americans are. But for some reason, the Americans cannot see them. They come out and there's no air. We cannot. The Syrian army and the Russians, they don't want to use the air force because they will be hitting the American army base. So every once in a while, we hear a terrorist attack on a bus for civilians, for the Syrian army in the desert of Syria by ISIS.
Now, the situation, as you have described it, is, of course, not complete, but getting there. On the diplomatic level, Syria's position has considerably strengthened. For President Bashar al-Assad to be visiting certain Arab countries that not so long ago were trying to destroy the Syrian Arab Republic. It's quite a diplomatic triumph, isn't it?
It is. But these meetings and this negotiation with the Arab countries has been under the table in the secret, because those Arab countries and those Arab nations, they were taking orders from the Americans, because, as you know, not the Gulf or the Europeans or anyone who works with the Americans can say no to the United States. So they were taking orders by the Americans, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and others. But now, as we can see, slowly they are starting to, as we saw the position of the UAE in for the oil, pumping more oil in the market to for Russian oil, they refused. So we are starting to see the negotiations, let us go back to the main point, the negotiation with Arab countries, and we're going to see more visits, and we're going to see more embassies open in the near future in Syria, because as the war is finished, we can say military war is finished. The opposition, each part of the opposition is in one side. One is in Turkey, the other one is in Qatar, the other one is in Egypt, and like they're scattered, they're ununited. And the countries who made those opposition and who sent the terrorists, they figured out that this is a lost case, as ex foreign minister of Qatar said that about this war on Syria. He said in an ex-interview, not the one lately with a Kuwaiti journalist, but one before, two years ago, and he said that we lost the war in Syria when we started fighting with each other. And that's what he means when the war between Qatar and Saudi started. So Saudi Arabia, UAE, Egypt, we're going to see more negotiations, more countries opening on Syria, and especially now it is connected to the Iranian nuclear deal. We are going to see, as I say, we might be seeing a Middle Eastern trying to decrease. The Americans, they want to decrease the tension in the Middle East just because they want to concentrate on signing the agreement with the Islamic Republic of Iran on the nuclear deal.
Stephen Sahyouni, thanks for flying with us on board the Sputnik. Much obliged to you.
Thank you very much.
Well, alas, that means it's the end of the show.
But you can stay in touch with us on our social media, on Twitter and Instagram, RT_Sputnik, on Facebook, Sputnik on Russia Today. It's goodbye from me, Gayatri.
And from me, George Galloway. It's been marvellous.